I am so pleased and grateful to be here today presenting the keynote speech at this 15th annual International Congress on Natural Medicine. I am excited to relay the information that I've acquired over the course of my career, some exciting stuff that I'm so passionate about and I love teaching on, but I'm also excited to hear the other speakers, my esteemed colleagues, who have their own interesting stories and information to give to all of us. So this is going to be a great weekend. I want to just spend a moment just sort of explaining a little bit about what I intend to do. I have three different talks that I'm going to be giving. Today, the functional endocrinology talk, going from past to future. And I will spend time tomorrow on the topic that is near and dear to my heart, and that is mast cell activation syndrome. And lastly, I'm going to meld the two together, the interaction between this condition, mast cell activation syndrome, and hormonal imbalances, specifically looking at polycystic ovarian syndrome. And so that's how I'll end. So without further ado, I'd like to start my talk then on functional endocrinology. My objectives today are to define endocrinology of the past, spend a little time understanding where the concept of endocrinology came from, and then fast forward to present endocrinology, and then finally functional endocrinology, which is sort of in line with the, I guess, what we would call traditional views on stuff, and then look at the future, which is my main concern. We're in the future, actually, right now, and my concern is, where do we go from here? You know, what has been done, you know, the way we've thought about endocrinology all this time, in the last 100 years or so since endocrinology was first identified, actually in 1909, that term endocrinology was created. Since then, we've been looking at very specific interactions. We've learned about the hormone that is a messenger, it's a chemical messenger, which is spread from cell to cell, and it's involved in coordinating activities and growth of different parts of the body. And we've looked at the end organ, so we look at the hormone, and we look at where it's going. And we've done that for over 100 years, always looking at them specifically, right? Even in the functional medicine world, which we're going to talk about a little bit, we are also a little bit, unfortunately, focused on cause-effect, or, again, one small piece of a bigger system, a bigger puzzle. I am concerned about understanding that hormones are not the way we've traditionally thought of them. They are, but there's more to the story. And we now need to understand how we interact with the environment. We are not just a soul self with these little things happening within us. We are part of a bigger universe, and we are definitely in relationships with the environment that's impacting our hormones and our endocrine system. So I want to just spend a moment. I'm certainly not an expert in Ayurvedic philosophy, but I think it's actually very interesting to think about where medicine started or the concepts of how we understood the body. What we understood were that all things in the universe, both living and non-living, are joined together. Self and environment are deeply connected. Balance in the connectivity ensures good health. And I want to emphasize the word balance, because that's what we're going to be talking about. Many of us who use or practice functional endocrinology as part of our practice understand that we're always looking for balance. And in fact, I'd argue that anybody who's practicing holistic medicine is also looking at balance between all the different systems and the outside. But we've sort of lost this a little bit, and in my view, and we need to sort of come back to this. And rather than focus on, let's say, the thyroid and treating with thyroid hormone or the adrenal glands and always wondering about balancing, you know, adrenal fatigue, those are all important. But now let's understand the bigger picture and how those different hormones are interacting with each other and how they're interacting with other systems in the body and how the world is interacting with us. So just to define endocrinology, give some basics, endocrinology is a specialty dealing with the diagnosis and treatment of disorders of the endocrine system, and its specific secretions or hormones, right? So very basic. And, you know, but again, I think that that we have come a long way from the past definition, which is over 100 years old, to where we are now, but we haven't come far enough. So in the present, we've definitely understood that the balance of hormones is important in achieving what we call homeostasis. And homeostasis is stability. It's balance between all elements. And we know that the endocrine system is directly controlling this process of homeostasis. What we also know in present-day endocrinology is that the hypothalamus, which is a collection of cells in the forebrain, is really primarily responsible for homeostasis. So much of what we talk about in the endocrine world is looking at the different axes, which I'm going to show you in. There we go. There are different axes that the hypothalamus is interacting with. We know that the hypothalamus directly talks to the pituitary, and we know the pituitary acts to the adrenal glands, the gonads, the thyroid, the pineal gland, somatotropic. We understand these interactions, and we now understand that there may be more to the story, that maybe it's not just the hypothalamus reacting specifically to the pituitary. Maybe the hypothalamus is actually reacting to the other organs or end organs. And so it's much more complicated than we've thought or believed. This is an image from a study that was looking at hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis modulation of corticosteroids. And so corticoids. What we're looking at, let me go back to that image, is the effects of stress on the hypothalamus. And the question the authors raised was, is it stress that is directly affecting the hypothalamus, which is then leading to the production of steroids and then causing heart disease, vascular disease, obesity, et cetera? Or was the stress or was the steroids themselves affecting those end organs? And so the question is actually, I thought it was sort of a silly question because isn't it all the above? Isn't stress affecting our hypothalamus and pituitary? And isn't stress actually directly affecting our organs as an end result? And so, yes, it is. And so this is present day, this is what I would call present day endocrinology, just looking at these very specific interactions. So then we fast forward to this concept of functional endocrinology, which is where I really love to live. And the nice thing about functional endocrinology is that we are starting to really understand that there's more to the story. We understand that there's an interplay between the environment and the body. We think about the body, the mind, and the spirit in each individual patient. And we think about the root cause. Why does health decline? Why does the aging process occur? And what can we do to change it? And so I think that's really powerful. So now we've moved a little bit from just understanding the thyroid hormone has a specific function to what may be causing the thyroid gland to go awry and what is that, how is that impacting the nervous system, the immune system, and all the other parts of the body. So a few tenets that I really believe are very important for all of us who are seeing patients is listen to the patient, number one. Always listen to the patient. They know their condition better than anybody else. They've lived in their body for as long as they've lived, and they understand why things. They understand better actually why they may not be well. So always listen to them. And so what I do is when I speak to them and I want to understand their endocrine issue or their neurologic issue or their immune dysregulation, I'm gonna help them identify their story. We're going to look at triggers. We're going to look at stress and how trauma affects them, how their different life events affect them. Sometimes they don't even realize it or haven't thought about a specific event in a specific way and haven't realized that it's affecting them and their health. So I help them along the way. I think, and as Danielle mentioned earlier, I've been a real active proponent for lifestyle, diet, exercise even before I even started medical school. I just didn't understand that as a doctor I could do both. I could talk about both. And very important is understanding the patient's history from start to finish. And one of the concepts that I will cover during this conference several times is this concept of epigenetics and the impact of the environment, past exposures to past family members, and how that impacts their health overall and their endocrine system. So what I want to do is just give you a little overview of how I think about the patient. We're going to go through my workup and some tests that I think are important. And then we'll talk about the future of endocrine. And then finally, I do want to mention that I will be discussing a case, sort of putting this together, because I always think that always helps me when I go to conferences. So the blood work that I do includes sort of the typical things that maybe you all do. We're looking at hormone levels, actually, in the serum, in the blood. I often do adrenal testing, and I'll test a four-point saliva test for adrenal and sex hormones. I'll look at urinary hormones. A thyroid ultrasound is often indicated in many of my patients. There is some abnormality that I detect. Pelvic ultrasound for females. So these are some, I guess, simple things. Again, I'm looking at these very specific things that I think are called what I would call the present-day functional medicine workup. Stool testing, and we're going to talk about the microbiome and its role on the endocrine system and intestinal permeability. So that's like the buzzword in the functional medicine world, but it's entering the traditional medicine world now, and that's very exciting. I'm obviously always looking at nutritional status, food allergies and sensitivities, which we'll talk about more tomorrow during my mast cell activation talk, the immune system, and then toxins. And so I put toxins on the bottom, but now I really think the toxins really should have been at the top. And there's going to be a lot of talk this weekend about toxic exposure and what that's doing for all of us. Let's spend a moment then talking about the microbiome. This is a really great study. You know, I have in my presentation lots of different studies that I've reviewing, and I'm trying to make this easy because I know all of you don't have time to read every single study. But this was a really good one if you really want to get some information. They have some great images, which I have here in the slide deck. The microbiota is actually an endocrine organ. And this is something that really was really astonishing to me, but it really resonated, because we've all also thought about those traditional endocrine organs. Now we understand that many other organs in the body, including the gut microbiota, are actually playing a role in interacting with our own hormones, even producing our own hormones. And then this is what this study shows. And this is a list of what they call candidate hormones for the gut microbiota. And short-chain fatty acids, I'm sure many of you have heard, are really what I would call the food for the good bacteria. We know that the short-chain fatty acids have far-reaching effects, not just for the microbiota themselves, but on us and our own health. We know that the bacteria produce neurotransmitters or are involved in the production of precursors for neurotransmitters. And so this is when I saw this, it really started to make me understand that, again, we're dealing with more than just our own organs, right? This is sort of showing that the microbiota is involved in the production of these different chemicals, which go through the intestinal epithelium into the bloodstream and then have far-reaching effects. So this is what we need to start paying attention to, right? I think many of us do, of course, as part of our practice, because we've heard about this. But more and more, this needs to be more the future of endocrinology. This was a fascinating review of a study that they did, which really makes sense. What they did was they had mice that were both what they call normal mice, and then they had mice that they sterilized. Sterilized meaning they removed all the bacteria from their gut. They basically cleaned them out. And when they fed those mice, the mice who did not have any bacteria, a Western diet, which was high in fat and carbohydrates, the mice did not gain weight. But if they fed the same diet to mice that had an abnormal gut flora, they gained weight. And so this is sort of what I think about as I think about the obesity epidemic, which is multifactorial, no question about it. But it's not just about the McDonald's, and it is on many levels, I have to be honest, right? But it's not just about that. It's about all these other things that people are being exposed to that goes beyond genetics, goes beyond anything else we know. And the abnormal gut flora that many of us carry are leading down this dangerous path to obesity. So, you know, when I think about then my workup, I'm always thinking about, okay, how do the pieces come together? Do they come together? And is there a root cause or root causes? And, you know, I have to be honest, you know, there are times when the root cause is not so obvious. It definitely takes a lot of digging. And sometimes there are multiple reasons why a patient has come down that path. But I think it's imperative that we, as practitioners of patients who have these multi-system chronic diseases, that we work on finding what the root cause is and eliminating it as much as we can. So I question what is really going on then. So if I look at my patient population, over the last 5 years, the number of patients that come to me with chronic diseases like I've never seen before, sicker and sicker patients, it's mind-blowing to me. I wonder, what has changed? Why are my patients sicker now than they were 10 years ago or 20 years ago? Not that there weren't sick patients, don't get me wrong, but the every day when a patient comes in my office, I wonder, that patient seems sicker than the patients I saw the day before or the day before. And so what is going on? And I'm always questioning, there has to be a role for, there's more than just what's going on with this patient, right? There's a role for the environment that these patients are living in. And the environment is getting sicker and the patients are getting sicker. So, do you eat these with the mask on after it's being sprayed by pesticides? Yeah, it makes me think we probably should be because, again, our food supply is deteriorating and contaminated. And think about going and getting some fresh air. Are you crazy? That stuff can kill you. I'm not going outside. Although inside will kill you too. So what I want to do now is spend a little time talking about the environment and how that's really impacting the endocrine system specifically. It's clearly affecting more than that. And I think this is where the future, it's the future already, the future of medicine, and then how do we go to the next step? So if you think about it, according to, this is an excellent website, by the way, the Endocrine Disruption Exchange. I think it's called endocrinedisruption.org, TEDx. They have a list of all the known endocrine-disrupting chemicals listed on their website, 1,400 chemicals that directly affect the endocrine system on many levels, whether they block the effects of your own hormones, whether they mimic the effects of your hormones, whether they interact with other hormones. It's really incredible and mind-blowing. And I think this is the message, too. You know, we're here at a natural medicine conference, right? But this is coming from mainstream medicine. Okay, this is science that's out there, and anybody who argues that there isn't science is crazy because I can do a literature search in mainstream medicine and find the evidence. This is a timeline of basically the understanding of endocrine disruption and endocrine chemicals dating back to 1958. We've known that there are problems with chemicals in our world. Dr. Roy Hertz was actually a gynecologist who had an interest in, he started seeing the link between chemicals or hormones that were being fed to the cattle and the impact it was having on patients. So we already started to understand there's something, you know, is not right. 1958, and it's taking us this long to get to the point where we're sitting here and really talking about it at a major conference. That to me is mind-blowing. And so this is the pattern of different events that have happened over the course of the time until 2013, when the European Food Safety Authority came out with a statement basically saying that our food supply is a problem, there are chemicals in the food, and it's causing disease. And that was 5 years ago already, and we still haven't gone far enough. So just to define endocrine disruption, endocrine disruptors are chemicals that interfere with the endocrine system and produce adverse developmental, reproductive, neurological, and immunological effects in mammals. And endocrine disruptors are found everywhere. They are ubiquitous right now. They are found in the plastic cups that I saw in the back, the plastic bottle, water bottle in the back. They're found in flame retardants and in the food and toys that the kids play with. They're everywhere, and they're accumulated over time. So even things that have been discontinued, certain kind of plastics have been discontinued, those still stay in our body. They still stay in the animals. They still kind of get transmitted down the food chain. And so we are in trouble. So the mechanisms of endocrine disruption are basic, okay? So as I mentioned, they can block hormones, they can alter the messaging, they can disrupt hormones or hormone receptors, and they can be involved in epigenetic modification. We're going to talk about that, and that is really scary. Now, just so you know, I'm giving you a very negative, concerning view of endocrinology, but I do believe in hope. I am an optimist by nature, and so I think there is hope, and that's the point of talking about this, because once you have information is power, and if we have this information and we can change others' lives with this information, then we've come a long way. And this is just an image of what these hormone endocrine disruptors can do. And as you see, the hormones, if you take the first slide in A, or the first picture in A, you'll see that the hormones can react directly with the receptors. And they show it in B with hormone mimickers. So can you imagine something that looks like estrogen binding an estrogen receptor in the way that a normal estrogen would and producing a downstream effect? Cancer. Right? We know that many of these endocrine disruptors can turn on estrogen responsive types of cancers. So this is scary. And blocking hormones. You know, I think about these patients that I see who have what looks like a thyroid condition. And, you know, you work them up. It definitely looks like they have a thyroid condition. Their TSH is rising. You put them on thyroid hormone, and they don't get better. And then you go, okay, maybe it's the adrenal glands. And you start dealing with the adrenal, and they don't get better. Well, you know, one of the things that I do see very often is that there's something blocking the effects, that even if I try to overcome it by giving natural hormone, I'm not getting there, because we have these chemicals sitting there blocking the effects of the hormones. And no matter what you do, you're not going to get it until you remove the chemical. So EDCs are a problem. And there are many, many kinds of them. And we're going to look at, here's a list of the different types of endocrine disrupting chemicals. There are many. I mean, this list only, you know, includes a few. But BPA, we're going to talk about a little bit more at length. And I know another speaker is going to be covering it as well. Phthalates, PCBs, the list goes on. These are found everywhere. And you can see on the slide where they come from primarily. And this is the concern, right? This is looking at, in this case, a pregnant woman and her fetus and all the possible exposures she could have that's going to impact the child. We know that bioaccumulation is a problem. In 2011, there was a study that showed, they studied pregnant women, and they found that 99% of all pregnant women had PCBs, organochlorine pesticides, phenols, phthalates, PBDs, DDT in their body. And some of these chemicals, by the way, have been removed since the 1970s. Back then, there was known that, for instance, that DDT was dangerous, and yet, 40 years, 50 years later, we're still finding it in women, because of exposures from their mothers, et cetera, et cetera. So this is scary. And the thing to understand is that even low doses can be a problem. You don't necessarily need a high dose. You know, so some people will say, oh, I think it's okay. You know, I have a plastic water bottle that I drink out of, but, you know, I eat organic food and I, you know, do these other things. It's not necessarily cumulative. You don't need very much. And you don't need very much during very prime periods of development. So in a developing fetus, you don't need a lot, right? So here's a... what they call a monotonic versus non-monotonic dose response. The non-monotonic means that at very, very low doses, and maybe at very high doses, there's a dangerous effect. But maybe in the middle, maybe not so much. And that's how some of the chemicals work. And this is complex and not easy to sort of understand on an individual level. So again, the greatest impact of these EDCs occurred during times of development of the endocrine system. So not just developing fetus, but during puberty for sure, during pregnancy, breastfeeding, etc. So anytime there's a shift in hormones or hormone development, that's when these chemicals can have their greatest impact. This is a look at the different chemicals and how they affect the urogenital system, specifically in the female. And I think this will probably be covered by another speaker as well. But these are lists of things that we need to be careful, need to understand. In umbilical cord blood, they did a study. Again, here they are. First, they did that study in 2011 looking at pregnant women and what they carried. And this was done in 2012. And they measured umbilical cord blood, and these were the chemicals that they found in their samples. Huge numbers. If you look all the way at the bottom, the PCBs, there were 147 positive results. PCBs in babies just being born. Now, there's one subset of endocrine-disrupting chemicals called metabolism-disrupting chemicals, MDCs. And this is where we're going to talk about sort of the link between these endocrine disruptors and obesity, specifically. Here's a view of what we call obesogenic endocrine disruptors. Many of them we've talked about before. Many of them are on the slides before. But look at how all of these, including phytoestrogens, which are found in our diet potentially, can impact the development of obesity. Childhood obesity is a problem. And there was that great slide in the first presentation of that obese three-year-old. There's no question that many of these children are being exposed to these chemicals from birth, according to the umbilical cord studies, and disrupting their metabolism at a very, very young age. These are other chemicals that are involved in potential adipogenesis, things like even nicotine is on the list, pesticides, which we're going to talk about, and even arsenic. So all kinds of chemicals can have an incredible effect. I want to spend a little time talking about BPA, because it's something that I've been interested in for a long time, dating back to when I had my first child, and I was really thinking about that point, you know, what I was supposed to, I wanted to do everything perfect. You know, I was a new mother 16 years ago, and I really wanted to make sure that I wasn't going to poison my child, and so I did all this research. And back then, you know, there was an interest in BPA, but we didn't understand that really all plastics have some form of bisphenol. And so I was all obsessed about BPA-free everything, bottles and nipples and all those things that they needed. And yet, I'm sure he was still being exposed because we now know that there's more to the story than just BPA, right? So if you look at a bottle and it says BPA-free, don't be so free to buy it or use it. We know that BPA is an estrogenic compound. We know that it affects it blocks estrogen receptors everywhere. And yet, in 1960, The FDA actually approved the use of BPA in all these bottles that were being used by babies and children and all kinds of stuff. And it wasn't until the 1990s when researchers started to understand that, BPA was leaching and that was affecting, early on they realized in the 1990s that it was actually maybe contributing to the development of breast cancer. But the issue is not just BPA. BPS and BPF are two BPA substitutes, and those may also have similar effects. And I know that we have a great speaker that's going to be talking this weekend about those, all those compounds. But here's just a little organic chemistry for you and the differences between the BPA, BPS, and BPF. But there really isn't much of a difference. BPA has been shown to be an obesogen as well as an estrogen compound. And this study like really said it all to me. This is a new chapter in bisphenol A story. Bisphenol S and F are not safe alternatives to this compound. And again, all plastic will have one of those. The other issue is that many of these other BPA-free products contain chemicals that also have estrogenic compounds. They may be different than BPA. But again, plastic is a problem. And the studies show that early on, development, in this case, zebrafish, because that's very relevant to humans, but it is in a way, because we now understand that there was neurologic effects with BPA exposure and BPS exposure early on to these fish. So I want to then go back to what we talked about, the microbiota, and how the microbiota is affecting us on so many levels. So the microbiota is affecting hormone production, neurotransmitter production, but is it a major player in the toxicity of environmental pollutants? And I would argue yes, and that is the point of the story, that the microbiota are affecting how we deal with our chemicals. And so in some ways, it is protective, and in some ways, it's not. And there is a bidirectional interaction between the environmental pollutants and the GI microbiota. The GI microbiota actually have so many enzymatic capabilities and metabolic capabilities. And so again, it could be very helpful, but it may have a profound effect on how the body processes chemicals, and maybe in a negative way. So in this case, they looked at gut microbiota, endocrine chemicals, and the diabetes epidemic, and showed that the microbiota were directly responsible for the development of diabetes when exposed to these EDCs. So now I would like to take this information and share with you my approach to an endocrine, functional endocrine patient looking at what I would call the future of this functional endocrinology. So this was a 15-year-old boy who came to me with delayed puberty. He also had anxiety, and one of the major problems he had since birth was constipation. Now, 15-year-old, I mean, if those of you who see adolescents, a 15-year-old boy who may be not quite in puberty yet is not necessarily abnormal, but the mother was concerned because other family members had developed already by age 15. And so, you know, I always listen to the patient and I always listen to the parent, and so there is something abnormal about this case then. What was interesting about the history was the boy was born with intrauterine growth retardation, so he was already small at birth, and he was always following that low part of the growth curve, around 25%. So always a slow grower. The significant part of the history was that the mother had heavy metal exposure right before conception and probably during pregnancy with mercury. Okay, she knew it. She, in retrospect, understood that it could have been an issue, and that was her main concern, was that the mercury had somehow affected her son and his development. When I examined the child, he was Tanner stage 3. So he, you know, had some development, but was still very, very mild and slow. And he was fairly short with family members who were definitely on the taller side. I always talk about diet with all my patients, and I make them fill out a food diary for me so that I understand what they're eating. Because how many of you have had a patient say that they eat healthy? Right? And then you go, well, okay, you know, that's great, but can you just like just start from breakfast and just give me an idea of what healthy means, right? And then you go, okay, it's the sugar cereal in the morning with milk because that's healthy because it has vitamins in the cereal. And, you know, and so you so on and so forth. So what was very clear with this patient is that he had really was eating a lot of processed food, non-organic meats and vegetables, if he was eating vegetables, and a little bit of fruit. And he was eating school lunches. And I actually think that's very significant. I don't know how it is here in Australia, but in the States, the school lunches are atrocious. They have nutritionists who run the school lunch programs. And I actually had a conversation once with one of the nutritionists about what schools have to do to make sure that they're feeding the children healthy. And so what they do is they calculate on a 5-day a week basis how many grams of protein, how many grams of carbohydrates, how many grams of fat would be good, and they split it up. So let's just say they know that the children need 20 grams of green beans, I don't know, vegetables or something. Then they can put that all in one day and for 4 other days not have anything else, because they've met the requirement for the week, right? So you could have chicken nuggets and french fries one day, and that's a complete nutritious meal, because tomorrow you're going to have peas or something, peas and carrots. So this child, I knew we were, you know, there's more to the story, there always is, but I love going to the diet and understanding the impact it's having on him on many levels, including the microbiota, which we're gonna look at. So I did a lab testing on him. I started with blood. I did a few different things on him. And what you'll see is that there's nothing crazy. Everything actually was in the normal range. But his testosterone, I would say, is fairly low for a 15-year-old at 143. But he wasn't developing yet, so some would argue that it might be normal. His DHEA, I would consider DHEAS, was definitely on the low side for a developing young man. And his pregnenolone, which is the mother of all hormones, is definitely low. And then I did a stool test to look at his flora. This is a simple test. This is certainly not one of the best on the market. There are others that really go into depth and measure hundreds of different bacteria. But just basically, it's very clear. We're looking at beneficial bacteria. We're looking at what I call the bad bacteria. And he has a lot of bad bacteria, 2 strains of strep, staph, hemolytic, E. coli, citrobacter. So his gut is a mess. But he didn't have any yeast. But who cares, right? All the other stuff is bad enough. Now, what was interesting, and I see this a lot in my patient population, is when the patient's system is out of whack, their endocrine system is not working, it's impacting their nervous system, it's impacting their immune system, ultimately they wind up with these levels of viruses, bacteria, and the like. And in this case, he had actually a reactivation of herpes virus 6, which is the roseola virus, which is usually acquired very, very early on, you know, in the first couple of years of life. And usually it's acquired and it's dealt with and the body sort of suppresses it or cures it. In this case, he reactivated it. And that's not uncommon with the patients that I see, that their immune system is so compromised because of all these other systems and how they interact with each other. So he was not symptomatic from what we could see, but this was concerning to me. And I'll mention the last 2 pieces on the slide is really just a brief view of what I'm going to talk about tomorrow. And that are these 2 levels called histamine and chromogranin A. We're going to talk about that because that is a sign to me of the presence of this mast cell activation syndrome, which he definitely had and which was definitely related to much of his presentation. But we're going to focus on that a little bit more tomorrow. But I just wanted to make a point that those two levels alone, both being positive, was enough for me to say his immune system was suppressed, dysregulated, dysfunctional, and he does have mast cell activation syndrome. This was an amazing test, and so now I'm setting the stage, and I understand that he's had some toxic exposure from what the mother says, and you know he's not growing, and he has an immune problem, but I wanted to really look at the effects on an epigenetic level. And this test, to me, is really the forefront of the future. This is a lab, IGL. They're out of Germany. They're a very small lab, and they're really trying to start with a small number of samples. And so I'm one of the doctors who's been working with them in the States for looking at what they're trying to do, and that is trying to identify toxins at a cellular level, an epigenetic level. And the question is what we can do with this information, and that's always the question. But the point is that this is a blood test. They extract his cells. They look at his white cells, his red cells, and they look at the membrane, the cellular membrane. They look at the nuclear membrane. They look at the mitochondria, and they look at the mitochondrial membrane. And they see that, and they can find what may be, I'll use the term sticking, in the wrong place. What is affecting the cell function? And in this case, they found something called lindane. I'm going to actually show it on the next slide. I think it's a little bit easier to see. Lindane is a pesticide. And it was found in his cell on a gene called the P53 tumor suppressor gene. So this lab is able to identify the actual toxin and where it's sitting and what it might be doing. We know that in genetics, right? We all acquire all these genes, and many of us have bad genes and good genes. Many of us have cancer genes or cancer suppressor genes. We do not know if those genes are turned on and active or turned off, okay? That would be great, and hopefully that's where the future of medicine is going. But now we have some tools, and we understand that there could be things that attach to the DNA that could turn on or turn off the gene. And here we see, although I can't prove with this test that this lindane is actually turning on or turning off the tumor suppressor gene, in a 15-year-old child, when I see this, I'm scared. Because tumor suppression is preventing cancer, and we have no idea what this pesticide is doing on this level. In addition, they looked at his mitochondria, and they found that that same lindane was causing his mitochondria to clump. And when they clump, they don't function very well, so it's going to definitely lead to mitochondrial dysfunction. And it was binding to the mitochondrial membranes. Okay, so this child, in retrospect, by the way, when we went back over his history, there was definitely fatigue, decreased exercise tolerance, poor muscle tone. So it was sort of like the mother didn't even realize that she thought that was sort of part of who he was. And we actually found that there was more to the story. There's a reason. And lindane is a really crazy thing because it's a pesticide. It's actually a neurotoxin. It interferes with GABA neurotransmitter function. In fact, the kid said that he was anxious. But the lindane actually was approved for a long time as a pesticide, was removed. The WHO classified lindane as moderately hazardous, restricted its international trade. But yet in the United States, we continually used it for the treatment of things like lice and scabies. So it's dangerous, but put it on your body and your hair and everything else. And so this is very concerning. And the problem with lindane is that it does have estrogenic effects. So it was probably affecting in this child his hormone regulation, right? There's no question in my mind. We're going to talk about histamine and mast cell activation tomorrow, but I wanted to give you a little preview. The fact that pesticides impact mast cell activation and impact the mast cells themselves and cause histamine release. And this child's histamine levels were high. The fact that lindane can affect the immune system on this level then explains maybe why, and it may be a stretch, why the viral activation occurred. So what do I do in a case like this, right? This is complicated. The mother's overwhelmed with the information. I always have to balance, you know, how much information we want and how much we don't want. And she was interested in sort of this experimental test. And so we went down that path and we find this information. And I always say, you know what, let's start with the basics. Let's educate. If I can educate one patient, they hopefully will pass the word down to their friends, and then I educate you all and you pass it down, because it's the only way we're going to get anywhere. So we educate the patient about food choices. He's old enough now that you can talk to him about, you know, maybe not doing school lunches or choosing better food at school lunches and maybe eating more salad at home and organic food at home. And so those are all important. The question is where this kid got the lindane from, we'll never know. He didn't have lice, so the mother never used lindane on him. But clearly, he acquired this either through exposure in food that might have soaked it in over time from many years ago or from the mother herself. I think it's very important that we target the microbiome, right? So I'm going to sound like a broken record, but we do need to understand that impact on the gut flora, and we've got to work there. So probiotics, that sounds cliche, you know, probiotics, short-chain fatty acids, the good diet, and detox. And we used a new protocol called the phosphatidylcholine membrane exchange protocol to actually help to wash off the pesticides. And I'm happy to talk to those of you later about it. It's a little bit of an interesting sort of treatment. So we repeated some testing, and just so you know, that we didn't really even detox him in the traditional sense, but we changed his diet, we worked on his immune system, we worked on all the things, and his testosterone level went up just within a few months from 143 to 433. It's quite remarkable, and we weren't even finished yet, so it's pretty remarkable. So I always think about, you know, again, what are the messages we're trying to spread? We need to teach our patients about the importance of picking the right food, know your plastics, and try to avoid plastics if possible. These are some signs you might see on bottles, but the bottom line is they're all sort of bad for you. Looking at things you use in the kitchen, plastic wrap, aluminum foil, there's so many things that these chemicals are hiding in. Looking at cookware, I always talk to my patients about what they should be cooking in, cast iron or stainless steel, avoiding the Teflon-coated pans, which are, we're soaking up the chemicals from that as well. I always, you know, talk about filtering water, avoiding canned foods and fatty fish. But you know what, this list sounds like, do I talk to all patients every single time about all of these, right? It's overwhelming. And that's why I think it's important that all of us start to think about how we're going to reach the public, how we're going to help them make the changes that they need to make. But it's a group effort, right, because it's a global problem. So I want to end then with the future of functional endocrinology. Not that, you know, we're living in a depressing world, toxic world, and we're never coming out of it, but that we have hope. Knowledge is power, as I said, and if we can work together to understand, to better understand, the impact of modern-day living on humans and animals, we can make some changes. We need to reverse the changes. Never underestimate the toxin burden we all carry. And so it's important that in each and every patient, even if this is not on your radar, that it is on your radar, that you explore with them how these things could be impacting them. And the question of the day is, can the microbiome save us? And I would argue, probably. I'd hope so. It's part of the answer. And that's where we will be looking for the future. I thank you all, and I look forward to seeing you again tomorrow.
Thank you.